Hello, I'm Matt Matem. I'm now the editor of Total Film, now that Jane has moved on to pass as new. Welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And this week is going to be an extravaganza of Matthews, as we'll also be hearing from director Matthew Vaughan as well, who's going to be talking about his new film, Argyle. And this week, we'll also be reviewing Argyle, the spy caper that's one of the first big potential blockbusters of the year. And we're well and truly into award season with American Fiction and The Zone of Interest. And there's also a big family film, Migration. So we've got all that to talk about. But before we dive in, what have you been up to this week, Matthew? Have you watched anything outside of these films we're going to be discussing?
Yes, I'm afraid I've succumbed. I've tried to resist it, but I've started watching The Traitors.
Whoa.
Yeah, not well, my family had watched season two, which I hadn't watched, but then they went back and started watching season one. So kind of under duress, I started watching it thinking, what is this? I'm not getting into this, But now I've been watching it every night and I'm really into it.
Are you all watching it anew then? Have they not seen the first series before?
No, they didn't know. So okay. Yeah, it's all new to us. So I'm sure I've read somewhere what happened and who the winner is, but I can't remember. So
That to look forward to then. I did watch the finale of season two, of course. I won't spoil what happens in case you end up diving into that after this one. I've never seen any of the like Australian versions or anything, so now that I'm missing it sort of Wednesday to Friday every week, I'm tempted to jump onto the Australian one or something, but haven't quite done that yet. I was hooked on season two, and it's just utter nonsense and makes no sense. There's no kind of logical rules to the game. Yeah, there's not a great deal of skill involved in many ways, unless you are a traitor. Obviously, you're obviously playing a bit more of a game there, but there's just something just so weirdly compelling and addictive about it. And similar, when I watched the first series, I watched it quite a bit after it had actually aired, but luckily I'd kind of not really been paying attention, so I didn't see any spoilers or anything. But then that meant that when I was watching that, me and my wife were literally just burning through episodes like each night, like that true kind of binging, which I'm not really a great binger really.
No.
Then I just was couldn't stop watching them basically. So yes, that's also good. Outside of the films we'll discuss here, I've actually watched a few films for Sundance. Sadly go out to Park City, but they provide a limited selection of their films that you can view online if you're sort of accredited to cover the festival remotely, which I've done for a couple of years. It was a bit of a mixed bag what I saw, but there were a few things that stood out that I'd say are worth looking out for. Among those, I would say there was this a film that was sort of like, I suppose you call it a docudrama. I went into it thinking it was going to be a documentary, but it wasn't. But the main characters are kind of playing themselves. But it's called Kneecap. And it's basically the story of like these Irish rappers. It played really well there. It's got distribution, so we will see it. Curzon are going to be releasing it in the UK, so it will be available to see it at some point. It's just got this, it's basically about this hip hop trio called Kneecap and how they sort of came together. But it's really got that energy to it. I mean, it's always hard when you're comparing it to such a high watermark, but something like Trainspotting when you first saw that and just had that real sort of energy to it. That's what I felt watching this.
Wow.
In the Summers, that won a couple of the big awards there. That I really enjoyed that. It was clearly going to be in my wheelhouse because it kind of has shades of Boyhood and After Sun to it. But I would say for that one, I'd definitely say like not as good as those films for me, but a very, very enjoyable sort of debut there. And another one that is going to come to Netflix at some point called Skywalkers, A Love Story. And Matthew, I'll stop you now. It's nothing to do with Star Wars.
But it's basically, Google it. It seems I heard about it.
It's basically to do with these people who just basically climb really high, dangerous things. The love story element is focused on these two people and sort of follows their relationship. But really, for me, it was kind of like, decent as far as that kind of documentary goes, as far as the kind of the characters and the world and bringing you into this sort of strange situation. Even though I was watching it on the small screen at home, it was just stomach churning so much of the time. God. just in terms of the visuals, what they're doing, there's so much for it. It was obviously this kind of GoPro style camera work, but my stomach was churning the whole time, but I couldn't kind of turn away. So a bit like Free Solo, I don't know if you've seen that, but that kind of feeling. And it's quite Man on Wire as well, but While Man on Wire was like, I love the film, but I just couldn't shake the slight disappointment that when they actually get to the sort of walk at the end, it's just all kind of still photography, isn't it?
And so
It was just a slight anticlimax, whereas this, you literally, it's like the opposite, where you're just right up there with them, at the top of these ridiculous skyscrapers and things. Yeah, so I feel quite queasy thinking back to it, but because it's going to be Netflix, but if it does get any sort of big screen release, I would definitely be tempted. And to be honest, I would kind of watch it again when it comes on the small screen, just with
Yeah.
like kind of watching through my fingers. But yeah, so I caught a few interesting films, a few lesser films as well that I won't bother kind of going into now. But yeah, so actually for me, that was a bit of varied viewing this week.
Yeah.
And so after that, let's begin on this week's new films by entering a mysterious world of espionage in Argyle.
I certainly hope you dance as well as you dress.
There's only one way to find out.
You and I, we're not so different. Agent Argyle.
Little help? Hold on.
So this is Argyle, a very meta new spy caper from Matthew Vaughn, who of course directed the Kingsman films and the Kick-Ass films, among others. And much of the film's plot has been kept under wraps, really. But at this point, I think we can say that Agent Argyle, who's played by Henry Cavill, is the fictional creation of author Ellie Conway, who's played by Bryce Dallas Howard. And she thinks she's writing fiction, at least, but she ends up being pulled into a sort of real world of espionage when it turns out that her books actually mirror real world events, and some very dangerous people are very keen to know what's going to happen next in her stories. So before we actually review this film, let's hear what Matthew Vaughan had to say to our deputy online editor, Faye Watson, when the two of them caught up last week.
People.
Real life spies.
Why would they care about me?
Because you're a goddamn fortune teller, Ellie. Why can't you see? What you wrote in your new book actually happened, and you kicked a hornet's nest you didn't even know existed.
I'm in some really big trouble, Mom.
Oh, so now you're experimenting with drugs.
I want all assets on them now.
I need her to write the next chapter.
God, I hate that cat.
This can be quite a tricky one to talk about without giving too much away.
Virtually impossible.
Yeah, so I can imagine the press tour has been fun.
Well, it's been a lot easier for me and a lot harder for journalists. So, but yes, it has been a balance of keeping secrets without having boring interviews.
I guess I'd say that the film kind of straddles a lot of genres. There's kind of rom-com, action,
I think we were calling
movies.
It an action, one of the, what do we call it, an action comedy romance thrill ride.
Well, that's perfect. I was about to ask you how you would describe it for the uninitiated, but I think that just about sums it up then,
I think, yeah,
it?
Instead of a rom-com, com-rom.
Com-rom, okay, I like it.
Yeah.
And kind of at the heart of it are these two characters played by Bryce Dallas Howard and Sam Rockwell, who are absolutely wonderful on screen together. It's just a joy to watch them.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, kind of, at what point in the process did you realise that you had something special with the chemistry between them?
I always do chemistry tests before you make a movie. It's one of the things that I find bizarre is, you know, studio executives think, oh, well, we're going to cast this X with Y and it's going to be amazing. But you never know with chemistry. You could put the two of the greatest actors in the world and there may be a spark, there may not be. I ring up actors and normally they're famous and I say, look, I need to do a chemistry test. And they sort of get pretty angry about it. They go, well, I don't test. And I said, it's not testing, it's a chemistry test. It's a big difference. And for your sake, as well as mine and everyone's, let's find out if there's that magic stardust. And if there is, we should make the movie together. If there isn't, I've saved the world from watching you not be good in a movie, not because you're not a good actor, but because there's no chemistry. And chemistry, you never, ever know who has chemistry or not. It's pretty odd because, you know, when it goes wrong, it really goes wrong. When it goes right, it's magic.
Yeah, exactly. That's really interesting to hear that because I do think that they're becoming more and more rare, those kind of chemistry reads.
Because agents and the system thinks it's there to protect their clients. Most of the time it doesn't. It does the absolute opposite.
And Sam in particular doesn't just bring kind of acting to the role. He also kind of brings his dance skills as well, which make for some...
I think most actors like to ad-lib. He likes to add dance. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, if in doubt, he dances, and he's very, very good at it. Very good at it. I went downstairs. Yeah, I was so tired, and somebody said, try exercising to wake up. And I was like, okay, I'm not a gym guy. And I went down and I sort of got on the treadmill and I was loathing every second of it. And I looked over my shoulder and there was Mr. Rockwell doing the most aggressive workout I'd ever seen. That if anybody trains like a action star every day of his life, it's Sam Rockwell.
Yeah, because I was going to ask about that. Like, how did you, at what point did you decide that you wanted to kind of utilize that for, I guess we could say, some pretty epic action?
Well, I knew he was a good dancer, and there's a very, very thin line between dancing and choreography. And I realized this on when we did Kick-Ass, and Aaron Taylor-Johnson had a four-week window to learn the fight choreography, right? So he arrived with the stunt guys. About 6 hours later, he'd learned 4 weeks of all the action. And my stunt guys were just like, I mean, all of us, but they were like, and they said to him, remember, he wasn't a star back then. And they said, listen, if you don't make it as an actor, you're becoming one of our stunt team. And I was like, how come you knew how to do this? And he says, I'm a dancer. So I know choreography. You know, dancing is, you know, put your foot here, your hand there to the beat at this time, swivel, turn around. And I realized there's no difference between fight choreography and dancing choreography. There's a very thin line between them.
And kind of looking to the wider cast as well. Mm-hmm. It's pretty stacked. But yeah. In particular, I think Henry Cavill as a spy makes a lot of sense in as a casting.
Yeah. As a super spy.
As
a super spy, the cliche super spy is what I needed. And there is no one on this planet who, if you read an Ian Fleming Bond book, that is better for Bond than Henry Cavill.
I was going to ask if there was a specific kind of project that you'd seen him in that made you think, he's the right person for this, or was it just like a gut feeling?
No, I knew him. You know, I thought he was really good in Man from U.N.C.L.E. And he, you know, you look at him, he's exactly what you'd, you know, deep down you wish you could be.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of touched upon it earlier, but there are a lot of twists and turns in this film, mm-hmm. and obviously you don't want to give them away. And I know you've worked very hard to kind of.
No, it's no longer a twist if you do.
Yeah, so you're kind of keeping them out of the trailers and stuff as well. Mm-hmm. Did you have any kind of pushback from the studio when you were like, look, this is how I want to approach this?
No, to the studio's credit, I said, look, please don't do a trailer that gives it all away. And they're like, yep, they nodded. And I was thinking, well, that's not going to happen. And they showed me the trailer and the poster. And first of all, it said from the twisted mind of Matthew Vaughn. And they were nervous about that. They go, how does that make you feel? I thought, I think it's funny. I'm in for it. And my friends were like, you sure you're okay with that? And I was like, hey, it sort of sums up the movie. So why not? And then the punchline of don't let the cat out of the bag. I went, you guys are clever. Really, really clever. Well done, Universal.
And I think people have really kind of got behind that approach too. Mm-hmm. I've seen lots of theories and who is the author, all of that. Mm-hmm. Has it been kind of exciting to see that as a filmmaker, seeing people embrace it? Or are you kind of sick of being asked about Taylor Swift?
I wouldn't say I'm sick of it, but it is weird. Yeah. It's very strange when your daughter comes up to you and says, why didn't you tell me Taylor Swift wrote the book? And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about right now. And she didn't. And why do you think that? And then she showed me all the online speculation. If someone had told me a year ago I was going to be answering questions about Taylor Swift writing the book, I would have said you're crazy. So, but she didn't. And but the book is good. It's a really good book.
Another difference of this and your other films is kind of how much you've kind of cut down on the violence mm-hmm. to work into a PG-13 rating.
Yeah.
How was navigating that for you and working out how far to push it and where? And did you ever want to do a more violent cut?
You know, as I said, it was inspired by Charade and Romancing the Stone and North by Northwest. And these were movies that they didn't need to be an R. Like, the rating should be a reflection of what the film is, not trying to make a movie for a rating. So, you know, I don't sit there thinking this has to be R-rated or this has to be PG-13. It just has to be the movie. And then hopefully the censorship board, or whatever they're called, the rating board, agree, you know, and they get it right most of the time. I mean, I was in a few films that got an 18, which I thought was a bit too extreme, and I can't remember which ones. But I think now they've got it pretty balanced. We had to make a few little cuts to get it to PG-13 that two of them annoyed the hell out of me. But hey ho, I was like, really? That makes it an R? But we did that. It sort of made me laugh. You're not allowed to do, I didn't know this at the time, but you're not allowed to do headshots. Headshots gives you an R, chest shots don't. I said, I don't understand. Because shooting someone in the chest, that's acceptable, but in the head's really bad. I said, you know, I don't think most people care where you get shot. If you're going to get shot, you're going to get shot. So we had to get rid of some of the headshots. That was really weird, you know, because I didn't know that. I wish someone had told me that, because they didn't have to be headshots, by the way. That was the big learning curve I had. And you allowed one F-bomb. So we chose that at, again, the right moment for a character to do it. This is the thing that someone explained this to me about. This is how crazy culture and society or different cultures or ratings are. I was explained that in America, if you say, I'd like to f*** you tonight in a very seductive manner, you're going to get an R-rated. But if I say, I'm going to f*** you up tonight and I'm going to kill you, you get PG-13. In England, it's the reverse.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like it tells us a lot about the cultures.
Yeah. Isn't that nuts?
That is nuts. When you spoke to Total Film previously for our feature, you spoke about how you were hoping for at least two more Argyle films, including one that was bringing Henry Cavill back. Are both of those already in the works, or is just something you're hoping for?
Well, you know, don't count your chickens before the eggs, blah, blah, blah. Touch wood when I say this. There's a universe that we could be doing in this film, but people have to like the first one. If they like it, this has been a very enjoyable experience and a world that I'd love to continue playing in, and I know the actors would love to continue. So that is up to the public. If they give us a thumbs up, we will give them another one. If they give us a thumbs down, we will just imagine what it would have been like.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And your cat's in this as well?
My cat. Yes. Well, my daughter's cat is in it, yes.
I was just going to ask about how his ego is doing. Now he's a movie star. Is he unbearable?
Cats think they're movie stars. Have you ever met a cat that doesn't think they're the movie star, that doesn't behave like a diva? You know, cats domesticated humans. So... I think him being on a movie set and having everyone fawning over him, he was very happy then, and nothing has changed since.
We spoke a bit about kind of the future of Argyle. I guess kind of looking beyond that as well, you've got kind of other stuff that you've spoken about in the past.
Yeah.
There's that Kick-Ass reboot as well.
Being worked on as we speak.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, is that your next project?
No, I mean, I'm in a weird business logistical moment of my life where I got to figure out who my partners are going to be, you know, that we have a lot of things ready. So we have to make Kingsman 3 before Taron and Colin are just too old. There's the reboot of Kick-Ass, which the idea is so of its time that we have to get on with it as well. We would like to make the next Argyle. And then I have a musical, which I'm prepping at the moment as well. We're going to be busy. As I said, we've been polishing our weapons. We're now ready to start firing, but I just need to know what aircraft carrier I'm firing them from. Which I don't have in it. I need an aircraft carrier.
Just finally, you've directed kind of a few spy adjacent films now. Would you ever kind of see a Bond film in your future?
Never say never, but I doubt it very much. I mean, I love Bond. Bond has been a huge influence on me as a human being, let alone as a director. You know, I think the Bond world is the broccoli world, and they're the master of that domain, and I can't see them wanting me to be anywhere near it.
So that was Matthew Vaughan talking Argyle. So now for us to actually discuss the film, Matthew, you haven't had a chance to see this yet, have you?
I have not, no.
So obviously we've got a bit of an idea about what happens based on what I said in the run-up to the interview and then what we've just heard then from Matthew Vaughan and Faye. So you know we're in this kind of meta-espionage sort of world. From the trailers, I mean, there was this sort of tagline, don't let the cat out of the bag, because obviously, yeah. You know, Chip the cat plays a key role here. You know it's leading up to a lot of sort of fun and games. So I'll try and sort of go into it without spoiling too much. But obviously, we begin with this sort of fictional world where you've got Henry Cavill's agent Argyle, who's this kind of Bond-style super spy in this, you know, over-the-top spy world, but all created by author Ellie Bryce Dallas Howard. But then, basically, people are after her because her books turn out to be a reflection of what's actually happening, it seems. So people are really keen to actually know what goes next, how she knows what she knows. She's just kind of, you know, oblivious to all this. And then into her orbit comes Sam Rockwell, who is plays Aiden, who's a real agent and very, very different to Henry Cavill's spy. But he's kind of, you know, a real sort of super spy. And he has all these kind of like Jason Bourne type skills and things like that. So the last thing I'll say is, obviously, you kind of guessed this from the trailer, but Ellie ends up being pulled into the kind of action of this world as well. And as you can guess, it's one of those films where like twists pile upon twists and pile upon twists. I have to say, I wasn't completely sold on this as a film, sadly.
Yeah.
I liked the idea. I really liked the sort of the world of Argo when they're sort of building that, this really over-the-top spy world where we've got Henry Cavill. You briefly see Dua Lipa, the pop star who's kind of making an appearance here. And then he's also, in this world, he's teamed with like John Cena as well. And then I felt really quite into it when we're first learning some of these revelations and we're getting like Ellie's learning a bit more about what's kind of going on in this world, what she's accidentally got herself into. Yeah. And when we've sort of, she first, you know, gets taken on the run with Sam Rockwell, there's fun there. Matthew Vaughn knows how to do kind of like energetic over the top action. My main issue with it really was that I've just felt like I wanted more of the Agent Argyle side of the story. I just kind of went in thinking that was the kind of big selling point. And I felt like I just didn't get as much of that as I wanted. Whereas, you know, we get much more focus on Ellie and Aiden's kind of side of the story in the real world. And then I also felt it suffered a bit from that problem that some films have, that when you get twist piled upon twist, piled upon twist. I love a good twist and, you know, rug pull and whatever. But when they just keep getting piled on, I just find it hard to stay invested, really. Yeah. So whilst I was never kind of bored by it, it didn't quite deliver what I was hoping for. And some of the action as well, without going into too much detail, there's one extended sequence which felt very fake, basically, to me. It just felt very, very CGI fake.
Yeah.
And didn't kind of deliver in that sense. And then by the time it reached the end, I felt that it all just got a bit too silly for me, really. So I just wasn't completely convinced by this, sadly. But there's things I enjoyed about it. That those main cast members, I always enjoy Bryce Dallas Howard. And it is actually, I did actually appreciate here that it was nice getting to see her really sort of get on the action. That was kind of a nice thing about this film. But as so many films aim for that, romancing the stone kind of banter and rom-com element to the action.
Recently, didn't we?
Yeah.
Lost City and Jungle Cruise.
And I just didn't feel like it quite delivered there, to be honest. And as you'd expect, there's kind of, you know, potential for this. You could spin this into a much bigger world, and Matthew Vaughan's obviously talked about that. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see how, I'm very keen to see how the sort of general public take to it. And at the time of recording this, the reviews are still under embargo, so we don't actually know the general kind of, you know, Rotten Tomatoes score is going to be for it. You know, we haven't kind of seen anyone else's take, but yes, that was my thoughts on it. Do you think you'll end up catching it, Matthew? Or
I don't know about in the cinema. I'll definitely watch it because I can't really resist all that star power. Like you say, Vaughn always, he puts on a good show in terms of spectacle. Everything kind of looks really sort of lavish, big and lavish and expensive. So yeah, I'm kind of drawn by that and finding out what these twists are, because I take it, is the trailer quite misleading, would you say?
Reasonably, yeah. Not perhaps not as much as you might expect, but if you watch the trailer, you don't have the whole film spoiled for you. But yeah, because that's the thing, you said the star power, but I literally just didn't even mention that Samuel L. Jackson's also in it. Catherine O'Hara and Bryan Cranston are in it. There's sort of a brief appearance by Sophia Boutella. Obviously, she was in Kingsman back in the day. It's very, very starry. Ariana DeBose is in it as well. So there's lots of people in it. But again, some of them don't get as much screen time as you'd like due to the nature of the story. So yeah, so anyway, that was Argo. And if you fancy checking that out for yourself, that is in cinemas from Friday. Now, we're moving on to a completely different film, but it's also about an author's fictional creation spinning out of control.
Your books are good, but they're not popular.
Editors, they want a black book.
They have a black book. I'm black, and it's my book.
You know what I mean.
Look at what they published. Look at what they expect us to write.
I just want to rub their noses in it.
That was American Fiction. Matthew, could you set up the story for this for anyone who might not have heard of it?
Yeah, so this is one of the big kind of awards front runners this year. It's the directorial writing directorial debut of Cord Jefferson, who's probably best known for his TV work, like on things like HBO's Watchmen, Succession, The Good Place, and it's based on a book called Erasure by Percival Everett, which came out at the turn of the millennium. And it centres on this character's writer, academic Thelonious Monk Ellison, or the Monk, as most people call him, played by Jeffrey Wright, who's he's kind of a struggling academic. He writes all these very sort of highbrow works that aren't really kind of making any impact. But then he hears about this book that's written by Issa Rae's character called We Lives in the Ghetto, which panders to the black stereotypes, but it ends up being quite a blockbuster, quite a big hit, particularly with white audiences, perhaps because it seems to be reinforcing these stereotypes. And so Monk, kind of in a fit of pique at one point, he writes his own kind of rejoinder, his own sort of exaggerated version of black stereotypes. He writes his book called My Pathology under a pseudonym, Stagar Lee. And it ends up being a big hit. So it's kind of like Shades of the Producers in a way, but it becomes a big hit, much to his kind of his amazement and disgust almost. And things start to sort of snowball from there. And all the while he's kind of juggling his personal life. His mother is ailing and he needs money to pay for her care. He's got a brother and a sister. He's got romantic troubles. So it's all about kind of him balancing these two sides of his life, and as he kind of perpetuates this lie about writing this book, and as he gets into deeper and deeper trouble, things sort of spiral onwards from there.
And as you mentioned, it's sort of like an awards favourite. And
yeah.
So with the Oscars coming up, it's nominated for Best Picture, Best Actor for Jeffrey Wright, and it's got a few more as well.
Yeah, Sterling K. Brown as supporting actor.
Did you actually enjoy the film?
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I thought it was terrific. I mean, a lot has been made about this, but the fact that Jeffrey Wright is getting a lead role, I mean, he's so terrific in so many supporting roles, obviously in the Bond franchise and the Batman and Wes Anderson and Jim Jarmusch's films, but to see him kind of be front and center with such a juicy role as well, there's so much to his character. I mean, he's the best sort of grumpy academic since Paul Giamatti and The Holdovers. You can kind of imagine them sort of grumbling to each other in the staff room. So there's so many different shades to the movie, and yeah, he's absolutely fantastic. What I also loved about it is just how well it juggles the sort of the family drama, the personal issues, with this kind of satire and this kind of discussion of black representation in culture and stereotypes and tropes and cliches. It's got this whole kind of discussion of all that, and kind of working through that and making these very kind of trenchant points with a lot of humor as well. But at the same time, it's got this very emotionally involving. There's subplots to do with Monk's sister and his brother and his mother and his housekeeper as well. There's a very sort of touching subplot involving the kind of the family housekeeper. So yeah, I really enjoyed what a well-rounded, balanced movie it is.
Yeah, I agree with all that, really. Like you say, I liked all the stuff about the publishing industry and the film industry and comes into it as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, I saw this quite a while ago. I saw this at the Toronto International Film Festival in September, where it premiered. And quite often that is where, like, festivals like that, where films, they become awards contenders sort of early on from back there, especially because this won the People's Choice Award there, which is always a bit of an indicator of a film that's going to kind of go places and potentially be in line for Oscars. Like recent winners have been like Belfast, Fablemans. Yeah, it's often an indicator of a film that's going to go into award success. And yeah, so when I saw it there, it kind of hit me out of nowhere. But yeah, just really enjoyed it for all the reasons you mentioned, and it really, really does do a great job of balancing all those elements, because I really, really enjoyed this sort of romance aspect he has with Erica Alexander as Coraline. Again, just something which could just be a forgettable subplot. Even that, I just thought that was, I was really kind of engaged in what was going on there. Just really, really enjoyed it all around. So I'm not surprised to see that it has had this kind of awards success that it's had.
Interesting. The only thing I was disappointed is that it's quite a big cast, and you get this Tracy Ellis Ross and Keith Bay COVID, and they didn't have quite as much to do as I hoped. I was hoping they'd be a bit more involved in the movie, but that's just, I mean, just as a minor quibble, I just wanted more of it. But and it gets quite meta as well at some points. But I felt like it didn't. I mean, I think sometimes there's a tendency with this type of film, like this kind of satirical meta type of movie, to kind of keep escalating and then pushing too far. But I felt like it just went kind of far enough without becoming implausible.
So, yes, so that is American Fiction. And I'd say that's a strong recommend from both of us.
Strong recommend, yeah.
And so that is in cinemas on Friday, and on next week's podcast, we'll have an interview with Jeffrey Wright, which is happening after this one's out. But look out for that next week. And so now time for another film that's also being lauded this award season.
This is ja wunderschön. Yeah, the Azaleen. Here there's also Gemüse. Bisschen. Kräuter, auch Rosmarin, hier ist rote Beete, das ist Fenchel, die Sonnenblumen hier. Und hier ist der Kohlrabi, die Kinder essen wahnsinnig viel Kohlrabi.
Die herrliche Zeit, die wir gemütlich im gastlichen Hause verlebten, wird immer mit zu unseren schönsten Urlaubserinnerungen gehören. Im Osten steht unser Morgen. Herzlichen Dank für eure nationalsozialistische Gastfreundschaft.
So that was The Zone of Interest from director Jonathan Glazer, who his first sort of feature film since Under the Skin. So Matthew, do you want to start by just setting this up for us?
Yeah, so it's I haven't actually read the novel, but it's based on a novel by Martin Amis, 2014 novel. Essentially it centers on this Nazi family, German Nazi commandant Rudolf Hoss, who's played by Christian Friedel, and his family, including his wife, played by Sandra Hüller, who basically set up home next to Auschwitz, next to the concentration camp. And all the focus is on them, their kind of comings and goings, their kind of their day-to-day life. We only hear sounds from the camp next door, sounds and a few kind of visual cues as to what's happened there, while this family, this kind of very ambitious commandant, as he sort of tries to climb the career ladder, while his wife enjoys this home that she's making. She seems like she's found her kind of perfect spot. It's a domestic drama, but obviously set in this kind of very real, horrific context. But it differs very greatly from many other Holocaust and war films in that it doesn't show any of the atrocities that are going on. It's all kind of implied. And these Nazis carry on in a very sort of cold, clinical, business-like fashion. Yeah, so very different from previous depictions that we've seen. And a lot of it is told through the sound design and the music. And Glazer kind of created this sort of reality kind of TV approach by setting up all the different cameras around the house without telling the actors who, when they're on, essentially. So he's kind of compared it to Big Brother, which is perhaps not what you expect from a Holocaust movie. But yes, it does have this kind of Big Brother feel, where we are kind of watching these characters go about these kind of banal, mundane activities, but obviously in this very kind of terrible, horrific context.
It's obviously very, very different to any other Holocaust film. And it's obviously a subject that continues to fascinate filmmakers, but it just feels like such a different kind of take on it. And it's strange because we've just discussed this before, Matthew, ourselves, but it's rated 12A by the BBFC.
Yeah.
And it's odd because obviously on screen, it's not like there is anything that goes against that rating, but it's surely got to be one of the most like disturbing and sort of upsetting 12As you'll ever see, really, in that sense, because just such a strange immersive viewing experience. And again, this was another one that I saw and reviewed out of Toronto. I gave it 5 stars. To me, it will be one of the standout films of this year, like of the sort of 2024 releases. It's surely going to be sort of right up there for me. It's just such a strange and disturbing world to enter into, particularly the kind of soundscape of it. And not only Mika Levi's kind of disturbing score, but just the sheer sound design of like the kind of the background noise you hear from coming over the walls, basically. And again, it's rarely anything you can actually pinpoint and identify and sort of pick out the individual elements. But you just know this kind of low level cacophony, you kind of know what it means. And again, it's kind of so disturbing when you can kind of glimpse over the fence, like a train coming in, basically. And again, it kind of plays on everything that you know about the Holocaust. Yeah. And it's just, yeah, it's just such a kind of disturbing world to enter and sort of be so sort of aligned with these characters and the way they sort of talk about everything and the way they sort of frame their own problems and just the way the commandant, like he's like you said, he's kind of climbing the career ladder. You sort of see times where he talks to colleagues about the equipment they're sort of bringing in, and they're just discussing it in such a matter of fact way, as if it could be any work, you know, sales meeting or something. There's also, because Glazer has this real sort of like artist's eye, doesn't he? And there's some really sort of striking, like even right from the off, there's really striking things done with color and things like that. And you get these strange sequences that are almost, that are filmed sort of outdoors and almost with like a night vision sort of quality that give it this weird sort of dreamlike kind of feel. It's just, yeah, it was one of those films that just truly sort of got into my head and just haven't sort of stopped thinking about it. And it's one of those weird things that, because the subject matter is so tough and it is such a sort of disturbing prospect, I'm really torn between wanting to watch it again and not wanting to watch it again. And I plan to at least see it once more on the big screen just to have that full immersive experience. But just because of the nature, I just couldn't return to it loads. No. But it would obviously be like a strong recommend for me, but a very kind of disturbing one.
Yeah, same for me. I feel like I want to tell other people to go and watch it rather than seeing it again myself, because yeah, similar to you, it's really stuck in my head since I saw it. Yeah, it's quite a feat really to take these kind of monstrous and just boring characters and put them in and make this very kind of compelling, mesmerizing movie that feels like it kind of looks again at history that we know well, but makes it feel vivid again and vital, and just reestablishes how important it is to keep revisiting this, you know, keep revisiting this territory and showing it and reminding us just how awful it was. I really think he's just such the modern Kubrick. I mean, looking at his other movies as well, especially Under the Skin and Birth, I think
he just doesn't miss really, does he?
No.
And it obviously, sadly for us in a way, he doesn't make that many films, as this is only his fourth feature. And Under the Skin, was that like 10 years ago?
Yeah, 2013, yeah.
Yeah. So there was this kind of 10-year gap between these two, and there was reasonable gaps between his previous features, wasn't he? And obviously he's kind of done shorts, and I think he still does the occasional sort of commercial and music video as well, doesn't he? But yeah, in terms of features, he obviously takes his time, but it's clearly pays off. Yeah, again, like we were saying, this is one that sort of it kind of was almost like maybe a dark horse in the awards race, where it kind of crept in, but it's got 9 BAFTA nominations and it's got 5 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture and Best International Feature. Obviously, yeah, because it's all in German. But yes, that weird thing that we were saying, a sort of a hard recommend, a really, really outstanding film.
Yeah,
but just a tough watch.
Don't take the kids, even though it's 12A.
Even though it's a 12A, yeah. I think as well, if you did take anyone too young, it's just going to fly over their head, isn't it? With the
context.
Yeah. But anyway, so that is Jonathan Glazer's The Zone of Interest, and that is also in cinemas from Friday. And now for one of the most jarring segues we've ever had on the podcast, here is a film about a family of animated ducks.
What is this place?
We are completely lost.
Where's your mother?
That is not your mother.
We're trying to get to Jamaica.
Don't worry, Chump's gotcha.
So listen, Chump.
What? Did you just call me?
Sorry, I thought your name was Chump.
Yeah, Chump, yeah, that's my name, what?
Right, so listen, Chump.
What did you just call me?
I'm sorry, is everyone else hearing Chump? What?
So this is Migration, the latest film from Illumination, the animation studio who've made some of the biggest animated films of all time, with the Despicable Me franchise and last year's Super Mario Brothers movie, but this is their first original for a while. So Matthew, could you just say a little something about what Migration is about?
Yeah, family of ducks with an overprotected dad played by Kumail Nanjiani, and mum's played by Elizabeth Banks. And this family, the dad wants them to not go beyond their boundaries, to stick to where they are. But then they get tempted to fly to Jamaica. And after much persuasion, the dad agrees. And so they head off on this episodic journey to Jamaica via New York, and have lots of adventures along the way involving other feathered beings and humans. It's not pigeons. Pigeon voiced by Awkwafina.
Who is literally like contractually obliged to be in every animated film, I think, yeah. Isn't it? She's in Kung Fu Panda 4 coming up as well, yeah. Isn't she? And just so many other animated films. Like between her and Olivia Colman, I'd love to know who's done the most animated films in recent years.
Oh, they've got it sewn up, haven't they? Yeah, she's the bad guy. She was in The Little Mermaid. Yeah, I'm always happy to hear.
Yeah, same. Yeah, she has got a great voice, to be fair.
Yeah.
And so did you actually like this film? Because I've seen this as well. And again, I must say, sadly, I wasn't a big fan of this film.
No.
Did you like it more than I did?
I think slightly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you gave it a 2. I'd give it a low 3, I think, I was reviewing it. Perhaps I had lowered expectations. Yeah. I mean, it's a very kind of standard. We've seen this set up so many times before. The overprotective parent doesn't want the children to be too adventurous, but then kind of comes to realize that, you know, you've got to let them go at some point. We've seen that. I mean, Finding Nemo is the classic example, but we've had it in the Croods as well and countless other stories. So, yeah, I thought it didn't get off to a great start. I liked some of the animated sequences, especially in New York. I thought that was... quite lovely what they did with the flying sequences above and through New York and the detail you saw there. And they get kind of into these scrapes with this big sort of celebrity chef who's seems to be based on Salt Bay. I kind of enjoyed that. And yeah, I enjoyed Awkwafina. Yeah, I feel like the material wasn't quite up to the standard that Kumail Nanjiani and Elizabeth Banks bring. I mean, they're obviously very kind of adept comedians. So I felt like they deserved better. But I thought it was a perfectly serviceable, slightly forgettable animated fare.
I found the kids kind of funnier than the parents out of the main duck family. And there's one bit that it's in the trailers, if you've even seen them, but I won't sort of spoil it completely. But it's just to do with like birds going to the toilet in midair.
That was a one bit I thought was very
funny. And I liked the kind of like almost like Looney Tunes style expression of their eyes. I thought that side of the animation was nicely done as well. But yeah, I just didn't like that villain at all. I just thought he was an odd inclusion and didn't think he really brought much to the film and didn't really like the way he was done and didn't even really like the character design of him. Did you see it with a child in tow? Like
I did, yeah. And he didn't really enjoy that much.
Oh, didn't he? Oh, okay.
My wife and child and... We liked it, but he wasn't so keen. Yeah, he
said interesting. He
didn't invest in the characters. He found it a bit boring. So,
because I did see it on my own. So obviously, it does make a difference with this kind of film if you go with a kid, obviously, who's more into it. That's definitely kind of brightened a few movies for me that otherwise I'd have perhaps been a bit harsher on. But yeah, I just found it really episodic, and I found like there were moments that reminded me of other films in a sort of negative way. There's a bit that's strangely reminiscent of the new Chicken Run.
Which
felt just very odd. It must just be an unlucky coincidence, really. But I thought that similar element was really well done in Chicken Run, which I sort of, on the whole, enjoyed a lot more than this. So yeah, so it was a slight disappointment for me. You were a bit warmer towards it. So if you fancy checking it out, that is Migration, and that is also in cinemas from this Friday. So we're almost out of time now, Matthew, but what would your film of the week be this week?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I think Zone of Interest is the best film. Mm. But the one I'd be more inclined to go back to would be American Fiction, I think.
Yeah, both very good films. I'd have to choose Zone of Interest, really, as my film of the week this week. And like I say, I'm sure it'll rank very highly when it comes to my films of the year this year as well. It's going to be right up there.
Yeah.
But yeah, American Fiction, also great. Just a reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press the button now in your app and you'll be all set for future episodes. And we'd also really welcome your feedback on the podcast. Like, we'd love to hear what you do and don't like about it, or what you'd like more or less of. leave us a comment on our social media channels, or you can email us via totalfilm@futurenet.com. But before we go, just time for a quick question based on a couple of films this week. But what is your favourite new issue of Total Film is out now and featuring the epic Dune Part 2 on the cover. This is also, it's kind of a special issue for us as well because it was Jane's last issue as editor. Yeah, so we've got like a massive Dune cover feature there by Jordan Farley. And then we've also got like career interviews with Jack Black, Jesse Buckley, Thelma Schoonmaker, features on Driveaway Dolls, Diablo Cody giving us her screenwriting tips, loads more besides that. It's a great issue. So please check that out. That's out now. You can read more about it on the website and we'll drop a link in the show notes where you can find more info about it, including how to order it online if you can't get to a shop. But before we go, just time for a quick question based on a couple of films this week. But what is your favourite meta gag in a movie? So your sort of favourite self-referential or fourth wall breaking gag?
Can I go for a TV show?
Go on.
Well, yeah, this one, it used to confuse the hell out of me when I was a kid. But in the opening titles of the A-Team, this is it's obviously a clip from the show itself, but they used to repeat it every time in the opening titles. There's a bit where Dirk Benedict, who played Faceman in the A-Team, a Cylon walks past him, a Cylon from his other big TV show, Battlestar Galactica. And I just couldn't figure out how is this, what is going? And it's obviously a nod to his other TV show, but it just haunted me. It haunted me my whole childhood, trying to work out. I just couldn't compute this. And I've never been able to stop thinking about it.
The thing is, I find it hard to narrow down a favourite just because I've just always been a fan of kind of like meta gags and moments and things like that. And like I loved the first Scream when it came out. I just was just kind of blown away by seeing these characters kind of commenting on the films and stuff. It just kind of blew me away at the time and really sort of spoke to me. But the one that just popped in my head when this came up was the On Her Majesty's Secret Service when he says, "This never happened to the other fella." Is that the line? Yeah.
That's a classic. Yeah.
And then that just kind of, again, as a child, you're sort of thrown and thinking like, whoa, what's going on here? And it kind of, I like the fact that Bond's always been a bit sort of loose with its rules. So you can kind of play about with it a bit like that. So that's my pick for this one. But
One other, I remembered the Maverick. Do you remember the big screen adaptation of Maverick with Mel Gibson?
Oh, yeah.
Danny Glover pops up in one scene and they kind of they do double takes, they look at each other. And it was directed by Richard Donner, who did the Lethal Weapon films. So, and I was a big fan of those back in the day. So that always kind of stuck with me.
I mean, we've really crossed the Rubicon on sort of meta gags and things now, especially with all the sort of extended universes we've had and just the sheer number of sort of crossovers and just actors who've been in different things together. I remember when I was younger, it really sort of almost did my head in when Bruce Willis appeared in Friends, and in Friends they'd previously talked about how much they loved Die Hard.
Right.
I was always like, this doesn't work. But
yeah.
I mean, if you were sort of too strict on rules like that, you would just not be getting any of these kind of crossover films or certain people working together. But I was sort of used to always say, but in this universe, like Bruce Willis exists as a movie star in Die Hard. But, you know, before we kind of break your brains any further, it just leaves us now to say goodbye and see you next week. Bye.
Goodbye.